Guten Morgen.
Welcome to Algorithmi Podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me, my friend.
Well, you kind of invited me to your home. We are here.
We are here in your... Now I find my microphone. This is how professional this is. Thanks for letting us to do it here in your beautiful home in Grunewald.
You're most welcome.
Yeah. And over the years, my years on Act Label, we have had many, many talks, mainly in this place, sometimes in the Italian restaurant nearby, sometimes on a plane or train or backstage, sometimes at Elmau. We have had many talks about your history in the music business, and I think it's fair to share these stories with others. That's why we're doing this, just to capture some exciting moments of your life, your long life in music business. So this is the episode one, and it's called The Act Years, which is the last almost 30 years of
your... But there were 20 years before Act.
Yeah. That's the episode number okay. two. Yeah. So now let's go to the moment when you... discovered that you wanna put your own jazz label together. I understand you had that dream for many years, but
yes,
let's go to the early 90s when it actually happened.
Yeah, but no, the story wouldn't work unless you know the history of it.
Mm.
The history is that I was originally trying to become a musician.
Yeah.
I had a band.
Yeah.
Sidney Bechet turned me on to jazz.
Yeah.
I was 15.
Yeah.
At 18, I had my own band,
yeah.
the Red Onions, which of course was a tribute to Bechet already.
Yeah.
But then I realized I was not good enough to become an artist, and I wanted to be, you know, connected to the music
yes.
that I love.
Yeah.
And then I read the story about Blue Note, the founders of Blue Note, and I realized, hey, these two guys, they started Blue Note 1938,
yeah.
just about 2 years before I was born.
Yeah.
And they're both not musicians. They were just enthusiasts as myself.
One
was a photographer. Actually, I was also very much into photography mm-hmm. at that time
yeah.
for many years to come.
Yeah.
And of course, the other one was a salesman. And I was a salesman. So I felt, hey, if those guys can do it, maybe I can too.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when the idea started
yeah.
to have my own jazz label. It took a good 20 years before it came to fruition.
Yeah.
But that was the beginning.
Okay. We'll cover those 20 years in the next episode. We're doing this unlogically, you know, the act years first and then the childhood. I have many questions about your gigs as a drummer and all that kind of stuff. But early 90s, I believe that one of the ideas was to have Act inside of a major label, once you told me this, but luckily it didn't happen.
When I decided to leave Warner as head of Europe, I did it because also my fatherly friend and mentor, Nezir Ötgen, who put me into that position, I knew he had to resign because of age, and I felt without him, I don't want to be longer in that organization.
Yeah.
And I felt the time had come to have my own label dream come true.
Yeah.
After all these years.
Yeah.
And so it became known that I had this idea. And two of my friends, one a singer, artist herself, Annette Humpe, and another guy, photographer, Jim Rakete, they approached me and said, hey, if you make your own company, we want to be part of it.
Yeah.
And although at the time some people said, well, you know, be careful, because if you really want to become an entrepreneur, you might do it on your own. Anyway, then came PolyGram,
mm-hmm.
which is now Universal.
Yeah.
And they said, we love this idea. We want to have the distribution rights for this label, and we will finance the whole label, and we give you a very good deal. And I felt, as I'm also a businessman, I felt, if they finance the whole thing, and I don't have to touch my own money, why not? But it was a mistake. And it turned out to be, it only took a year and a half that I realized this is it. Because I felt no partners, no finance from third part. This is just the realization of my dream, and it's not a business concept. It is a mission. And the mission is that I want to discover artists mainly in Europe, because I live in Europe. Lived and still live in Europe. And I felt, a good label, an independent label, can only work if you have a very good and personal relationship to the artists you work with.
That's right.
And I felt, hey, as soon as a third, somebody else comes into the picture, it will be a problem. So I said, only on my own, with my own money, and I just had a secretary and one assistant, and that was it. And so we started ACT as a jazz label. And that was in 1992 in Hamburg.
In Hamburg,
because before I lived in London, I moved back to Hamburg, and that's the start of ACT as we know it today.
Yes, and then those two partners, they parted.
We still remain friends. No business.
And then you found your home base in Munich, and soon you find a good team, Michael Gottfried, Marco Ostrowski, Petra Deka.
The first 2 years we worked out of my house in Hamburg. And from there I felt, and especially my wife Sissy, she always wanted to live in, the lake, and she loves Munich, because we lived there in the 60s. And we said, okay, then we found a very, very nice home, not in Munich first, but in Feldafing on the lake, right on the lake. And the first employee that I found was, again, tip by a musician. In that case, it was Wolfgang Schmid, the bass player. And he said, hey, I know a bass player, female bass player. She's looking for a job. And so Petra Deka came to the team, and she's still a member of the team. She runs the publishing. So this is how we started in Feldafing, but then soon we realized it's a bit of, we wanted to be in Munich. And so we found a home for the office, and we started, then we found Michael, we found Marco, and it's a team that turned out to be amazing. They love the music, they love the work, and this is not a job you can do like 40 hours a week and 8 hours a day. I mean, it's a full commitment. If you're not ready to do that and think of what you do day and night and do if necessary weekends, evenings, whatever. Otherwise, it will never
work. That's right. It's a way of living.
It's not so easy to find these kind of people.
Right, yeah.
Some are enthusiastic about the music, but then they said, today is the work-life balance. Forget work-life balance if you work in this, scenario.
Yeah, sometimes you have to go to the concerts to meet the artist.
You have to spend evenings 3-4 times a week.
It's a way of living.
Yes.
But you really found a good team there,
I'm very proud of
it. Well, Marco has now left he was 15 years more. Okay, so and how did you find your artists? The first album, that was Jazzpania.
Well, because there are always there's music that you have you found, and it just kind of doesn't leave you. And one of the records that I would take to the, to the island, one of the 10 records I would take to the island when I ever go and live on an island, would be Sketches of Spain
by
Miles and Gil Evans.
Yes.
And this album was very instrumental, by the way, to get my very first important job. But we'll talk about that on another
in
occasion.
The episode two.
Always in, and of course, I was not only a jazz fan. I was, when I came to Hamburg, it was the same year, the same month actually, as the Star Club started. And I was just interested, and I went. And I was part of the rock and roll movement from day one, so to speak. I mean the English rock invasion that followed with the Beatles and so on. And so I have always been interested in more than just jazz. Jazz might still be my first love, but music in general is my love. And so rock and roll is a part of it. And also flamenco was always part of it. And so I felt I would like to do something that, you know, that Sketches of Spain never realized. It was not a flamenco fusion. It was an American record with a flamenco flavor.
That's right.
There was no real flamenco in it. And I felt, since I've always had the chance, I met the greatest flamenco players of all time, Paco de Lucía and Camarón de Isla. You know, they were the greatest in flamenco history. And I saw these already in 75. And I met them. And also I'd met the you know, the young generation of Spanish jazz musicians, like and I felt, hey, what we should do is a new, you know, an update, so to speak, of the ideas, but not Sketches of Spain, but call it flamenco jazz. And I had this, you know, the thing of España, which I think is a catchy name for the project. I started looking for the right Spanish musicians, the flamenco musicians, and also a big band. And with some American musicians. So I found a partner, so to speak, in Wolfgang Hirschmann, head of the VDR big band, and he said, yeah, let's do it. And he suggested, as we said, who could do the arrangements? And of course, Gil Evans didn't live then. He was dead by then. And he said, you know, why not trying Vince Mendoza, who was completely unknown.
That's right. He was very young.
And I felt, oh, maybe he even speaks Spanish. So he gave me the phone number. And I called Vince in California. And told him what I had in mind. And he said, and I said, by the way, do you speak Spanish? I said, no. We have Mexican family, but no, I only speak English. And then I said, but you see, the problem I see is, how can I write and arrange an album only based on three chords? I said, no, you know, you have no idea. You don't know anything about flamenco. Flamenco is the jazz of Europe. Same history, if you really go into it deeply. Because, you know, the gitanos, or what they call the gypsies, they are the same. They have a similar history than the black slaves in America. So this music is very authentic, and it's full of energy and drive.
And harmonies,
So he said, why don't you come to Europe? We go to Sevilla and Madrid and check it out. He did, and we came, and after two nights in Spain, you know, he became an aficionado of flamenco.
That's right.
And so we put this whole thing together and had I still remember it. The concert was, you know, 2nd of July, 92. And it was a concert at the Philharmonie in Cologne. And it became the album, not the live album, but studio recordings. And it was, in fact, the first new album under the ACT label. And, you know, and also I got my friend Arif Mardin, who to contribute part of the music, and he even came to the recordings, but he was so busy as the producer of, you know, of Barbara Streisand
and
the Beach Boys. He recorded all these incredible successful albums by the Beach Boys. So he said, I love the idea, I love the music, I will write a suite, which he did. And I come to Cologne to conduct the orchestra, but that's about
it. Okay.
So the rest was all done by Vince. And the record came out and was nominated for two Grammys.
That's right.
Not so bad.
Yeah, not bad. And you had the strong European influence and flavor from the start, from the record. Which is kind of the guideline of ACT, you know, to support the European sounds also. There are many Scandinavians on the label. Like me, but I think that the Swedish representation has been the strongest. Which one you met first, Nils Lundgren or Esbjörn? Or
Nils.
Nils first, okay. See,
I made it, you know, from the beginning, like, you know, as I discovered my very first artist in 1962, I made my first record, was Klaus Doldinger.
Doldinger, yeah.
And I saw him at a concert.
Yeah.
And after the concert, I went backstage and said, we have to make records together. Mm-hmm. Although I was absolutely not authorized to make that kind of offer to anybody.
Yeah.
So the same thing happened a few years later.
Yeah.
Namely in 1994.
Yeah.
So I went to the Jazz Baltica Festival up north in Germany.
Yeah.
And I knew I should find new artists at festivals presenting unknown artists. It doesn't, you know, I don't have to go to Montreux, which I still did, but there you cannot discover new talent.
That's
because
right.
This all is a festival of established artists.
Names, yeah.
And Jazz Baltica was a festival concentrating on unknown artists to Germany, coming mainly from Scandinavia and, you know, the
Baltic Sea region. Yeah.
So I went and the artist that completely put me on fire was Nils Lundgren. I saw him performing with his unit, as it was called then.
Yeah.
Maestro Parken, I was a guest artist.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely fascinated by the way he manages his instrument, great virtuosic on the trombone.
Yeah.
He's also a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And more, of course, he is a, you know, as in German, we would call Rattenfänger. So he knows how really to get an audience on his side. And you could tell he's an artist. He plays for the audience.
That's right.
And I always made it a point in all the years before when I signed artists, even pop artists, the main thing, I always had to see them perform in front of an artist. And I had to be apart from the musical qualities, artistic qualities, the main quality is his ability to communicate with an artist, audience.
Yeah.
And Nils was like the perfect example. So I went to see him.
Yeah.
Actually, I invited him to come to my country house, and I invited him to join the label.
But
mind you, the label was only 2 years old at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky because he had no contract. He had actually his own label, Trump Music.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, so first of all, he had a record made with this band.
Yeah.
That he released in Sweden.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, the first record, I can release this record outside of Sweden on my label.
Yeah.
But then we start making our own recordings for ACT. And that took 2 years actually it was only 1 year. He came to Hamburg to record his first original ACT album.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I told him, we have to change the name from Unit to Funk Unit. He said, why? He said, all my bands have always been called The Unit, but said, hey, you know, I was not looking for a white, blue-eyed kind of funk, but it's you that persuaded me.
Yeah.
And it's the music. And the music, you should call it what it is.
Yeah.
To make the people understand.
That's right.
This is not a, you know, like a copy or whatever.
Yeah.
It is, original music. So it's the Funk Unit.
Yeah.
He finally accepted, and it's still called the Funk Unit.
That's right.
After all these years. But when he came to Hamburg for the first recording, he had a young piano player, you know, who was then, he had a long hair and a bandage.
Yeah.
So he looked like a young Björn Borg.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Yeah.
But I never heard his name before, Esbjörn Svensson.
Mm.
But he sat then on the keyboards, not just piano, but then I realized this is a master at work.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we finished this album, which turned out to be really an amazing album. And it was all the guest artists we had, the Brecker Brothers and so on and so on. So it was not really the band that finally went and became the Funk Unit.
That's right.
But this was a studio band. World class musicians. Bernard Purdy and so on. So, but of course, then I talked to Espion, and he said, "Well, I have a band, and I have a label in Sweden, the Diesel, and we already released a couple of records. And so, why don't you release my albums in Germany?" He said, "Come on! I mean, I started a label to create new recordings, which should be part of my own world, and not becoming, you know, a paid hand who distributes records of other people."
So
I said, "Well, I mean, I listened to these albums. Yeah, they're okay, but no, we have to do something on our own."
Yeah.
So, but to get things started, I said, "Okay, why not making a recording, you and Niels, and go back to the, you know, to the history of Swedish jazz, which of course was, you know, the famous
Jan Johansson
recordings." And he first said, you know, and this has been done, and so I have no idea. So I said, "Listen, if you want to start working for the label, we should do something that I feel we can sell and we get you an audience for."
Yeah.
He agreed. We made the record. So the first tour of Germany and beyond was the duo, Niels and Espion.
Yeah.
You know, the record was called, you know, Old Swedish Folk Modern.
That's right. Yeah.
Beautiful album.
Yeah.
And then took a few years later, 99, then Espion had sent me the, you know, like the pre-recording of the next album he was about to release. And it was
The Monk.
No, The Monk was the four.
Okay.
And then came From Gagarin's Point of View. And I heard that album, and I said, "This is one of the best jazz records I've ever heard in my life." Mm-hmm. "And I have to have this band on my label, whatever it costs."
Yeah.
So I said, "Okay, politics, labor politics, forget it." So I went to Sweden and made a deal with Diesel to release the album outside of Scandinavia on my label. And then I made also a handshake agreement with Espion that when your deal comes up with Diesel and we are able to really get you, you know, a status outside of Sweden, then you should sign directly with my label."
Yeah.
Which eventually he did.
Yeah.
So, but the first release of EST was Gagarin's Point of View.
The album, which I think has When God Created Coffee Break on that.
Yes.
Another great tune.
Yes.
Okay. All right. And at that point you had the distribution, worldwide
distribution.
Yeah.
We produced records ourselves, we manufactured them on our own, we made our own designs, and then we had them distributed as finished product throughout the world.
And those two artists became, you know, the most visible ones for the next 10 years.
As it happens, they are still today, you know,
that's right,
the most successful artists on the label ever.
That's right.
And both have sold more than a million records, you know. Today, it's another situation.
Yeah, it's astonishing to think that EST only had more or less 10 active years with ACT. So from 99 to 2008, when we got the terrible news of Espion's death. Where were you then, by the way? Did you get the news?
This was a Sunday, by the way. I was at home, and I got a call in the morning from the manager, and I couldn't believe it. I had to cry. I could hardly speak, and it was for sure, you know, the darkest day in my life.
Yeah.
And because it was so unbelievable, you know, they were just about to start a great tour in the United States. They were invited to the New York Jazz Festival, and everything was in place for them really to have a world career.
Yeah.
And he was such a nice guy, most wonderful individual, you know, and of course, In fact, because he was also a family man, and his wife had insisted before they make this huge international career that they should spend a good time, a piece of time with the family, and yeah. nothing else.
Yeah.
So they went on a world tour 2 years before.
Yeah.
And in Australia, he fell in love with, you know, with diving.
Yes.
So they did, you know, and of course, you know, diving in Australia in warm waters is not the same than trying to dive in Sweden.
That's right.
So, and because he wanted to continue his sport,
yeah,
and started learning to dive in cold water with yeah. sweatsuits, yeah, whatever yeah, yeah. you need, yeah. then, and that became, you know, the tragedy of his life.
That's right.
He died because of it.
Yeah, and also because the water is very foggy. They couldn't see him.
Nothing.
I was on a ferry. I also remember it was a Sunday, and I was on a ferry between Tallinn and Helsinki, and I got the news as a text message right before there's 1 hour. You know, gap in the connection, and I got it from a musician friend who sometimes makes pranks, but I couldn't believe it. But for 1 hour, I was just thinking that, I mean, this must be a prank. I was hoping it's a prank, mm-hmm. but it wasn't. You mentioned world success for ESD, so. Without this tragedy, where do you think they would be now, playing big outdoor arenas?
Well,
it was really big already at that time.
They already played outdoor arenas.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and in America.
Yeah.
And well, you see, I think it's quite clear that they revolutionized the art of the jazz piano.
Yeah.
And because, first of all, you know, they were really equal. It was not a pianist with a rhythm section, you know,
yeah.
bass or drums. When he had his first success, real success,
yeah.
and I think we were instrumental in helping him to have this success
yeah.
in what we did
yeah.
in support of the band and he himself.
Yeah.
And also in connection, I must say, with Burkhard Hopper, the manager, Esbjörn always used to say, I have two trios.
Mm.
One is me, you know, Esbjörn, me, Don, and Magnus.
Yeah.
The other trio is EST, Ziggy, and Burkhard.
Yes.
And I think he was right.
Yeah.
It was really a good chemistry. But the important thing was when he felt that he could really become a world situation,
yeah.
he immediately stopped any other activities.
That's right.
He did not even agree to have his name on the label for a record that he did with Victoria Tolstoy.
Okay. You
know, he wrote all the music, he played the piano,
yeah.
and then he said, Ziggy, I don't want my name on the album.
Okay.
And, it, you know, so if you look at the album today, it's just Piano Broer Falk,
mm-hmm.
which is the second name of his mother.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
Anyway, but the thing is, he immediately, and also he made Don and Magnus stop playing with any other bands.
Yeah.
So for the years thereafter, they were just, this was really a trio. And I don't think there's any other trio, there hasn't been any other trio that consequent,
yeah. you know,
to say, this is our music. And when they said, you are, it's the jazz, he said, I don't care what you call it. It's EST.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
It might be jazz, it might be pop. For me, it's only jazz. It's only music.
That's right.
And it's my music.
Yeah.
So he was right. And in that sense, he became like a model for many other, for generations
yeah.
of young piano players. And of course, we shouldn't one forget to, two other things. He, again, like Niels, was somebody who really fascinated and charmed an audience
yeah.
wherever he went on stage.
Yeah. It was a different kind of approach.
A completely different
yeah.
way of, but still, in effect, he had the artists, you know, the audience on his knees.
That's right.
He sat on that piano on stage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. he was not speaking so much, you know, only presenting songs, yes, like after four tunes nonstop.
And of course, he was an incredible composer.
Yeah.
Because so now, I mean, you know, and even go back, tell me any other piano player, right, who has written so many melodies.
That's right.
That are, you know, they will go on forever.
That's right.
That's why the music is still, even today, after, you know, so long, he's still the number one act artist on Spotify.
With
over 500,000 listeners every month.
Wow. That is astonishing. A word from our sponsors. You can rest for 1 minute, but you know this sponsor. Genelec, leader in professional audio solutions, is proud to partner with Algorithmi Podcast. At Genelec, we blend art with science and engineering to deliver exceptional audio solutions that improve every listening experience. We're proud to support discussions that explore the fascinating world of music and beyond. I'm sure you have seen Genelec speakers in studios.
Yeah.
I mean, they're everywhere. So they are sponsoring my little podcast. We covered EST, we covered Nils Lundgren, and of course, after Esbjørn left this world, then you really needed to sign new artists.
And well, don't forget that you approached me, right?
That's right. That's right.
You approached me.
Actually, well, my last contact with Esbjørn was this. I tried to persuade him to play the lovely Mozart double piano concerto in E flat major number 9 for two pianos. So we had a talk about this at April Jazz just 2 months before he died. So that was, but he also gave me your phone number.
And you did. You called me.
I waited 1 year. Yeah, I waited 1 year. I didn't want to rush it. But yeah,
told me that you wanted to become a solo pianist. You know, you were fed up with bands and stuff. And I said, hey, you know, we can talk about it forever, but it's not, I can't dance to architecture. So you have to come and play it.
Yeah.
You came
to
this very room.
Yeah.
And you played me your music.
That's
your
right.
Own music.
Yeah.
And then of course we decided to work together, and then we recorded your first album in this very room on this beautiful piano.
Yeah.
And when we, this one tune, you know, that became, you know, like a signature.
That's right.
Melody, and I suggested call it Tears for Esbjørn.
In my sheet music, it said Ballad in F minor. That was my brilliant title for it.
And when I heard it, I almost, you know, got in tears, and because I was thinking about Esbjørn when I heard it.
That's
and
right.
Of course,
yeah.
We recorded that, and we used this title for concerts and everything.
And some albums also. Yes, yeah, well, at least one album. Yes, and it is my most well-known tune. It's my most requested tune. Sometimes I play a solo piano concert for two sets. I do encores, and then I sign CDs, and always somebody comes that, nice concert, but you didn't play Tears for Esbjørn. So that tune will follow me. And yes, I was thinking of Esbjørn at that time. I mean, I was generally sad, as I think everybody who knew him, yes, you know, that time. And it was written few months after we lost him. Well, what are you looking when a new artist is approaching you? What are the qualities you are looking? Of course, you mentioned you want to see the live thing, what things are you looking?
The music comes first.
Yeah,
because finally we are recording music and we are trying to interest people, and you know, this is our mission. You know,
yeah,
we have to find an audience for the music that's created by an artist.
Yeah,
and so the first thing is I have to be touched by the music.
Yes.
Number one.
Yeah.
But then, if you will sell it, but that's our job.
Mm.
You have to say, hey, then we need the artist to communicate with an audience. And if he himself, the artist, is not capable or not willing to communicate with an artist,
yeah,
then I can do what I want. I will never be successful.
Yeah.
So the next step always is I have to see the artist perform in front of an audience.
Yeah.
And if I see, yeah, it this works. Artist wants to play for people.
Yeah.
He wants to touch the hearts of people with his music.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm kind of staying away from a lot of experimental jazz, you know, Eiffel Tower thing or you know, I mean, there were some drastic names for that kind of music.
Avant-garde jazz. Yeah.
And no, I said, no, it's not. I want to find people to share my enthusiasm for something.
Yeah.
So if I'm not enthusiastic about it, and eventually I always ask myself, would you buy that record?
Mm.
And if the answer would be no, then I say, okay, then I shouldn't release it. Then I shouldn't make it in the first place.
That's fair. It's so very
this
simple.
Is really what gets me. And this is, of course, something you can only do with your own label.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, as a head of Warner and Liberty before, later head of Europe for Warner, you can never make your own taste, you know, like the guideline for what you do.
Yeah.
The guideline for working for a real commercial record label is making money.
Yeah.
And you have shareholders, you know, that look at your numbers every 6 months or 3 months even. And the music, you have to find the music that sells. That's the only thing that counts.
Yeah.
But no, my mission is to find an audience, the biggest possible audience for the music I love.
Yeah.
And that's what I call a mission.
That's right.
Certainly not a business.
Yeah. So sometimes you have encountered an artist whose music you like and you like the guy or a woman, but then you go to see them live and it doesn't work, and then you happened many times. Okay.
I remember when I got a call from the manager of Yun Sung Na. Okay. So they recorded an album in Sweden, in Göteborg, in the famous Nilento studio. And so they invited some of my artists, you know, of act artists, like Lars Danielsson.
Yeah.
And he was part of it in Ulf Akenius.
Ulf was there. Yeah.
So they were part of the recording.
And
so when they made this record, they had no label, nothing.
Yeah.
And the guys said, Would you know a label? He said, why don't you call our label, you know, Ziggy Loch in Berlin?
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah.
So, and there was a call from somebody from you know, South Korea.
South Korean guy.
I never heard the name. And I said, the story that, you know, she was a musical star, in South Korea, Yun Sung Na.
Yeah.
Actually, she was singing the main part in a musical that came from Berlin.
Yeah, yeah.
Kids musical.
Yeah.
And I said, that doesn't make her a good jazz singer.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, why don't you come to Berlin? We set up a private concert in my house.
Yeah.
And I have to listen to what she has to offer.
Yeah.
And they came, and the rest is history. I signed her.
Yeah.
And she became huge artist, you know, in our Croatian. Of course, eventually, unfortunately, we lost her to a major. Now she's with Warner, my ex company. But, you know, I understand. We had, you know, they were fair, made a 5-year contract. After the end, she said she wants to try to break in America.
I
never believed that this would be possible.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we would not be the right company to do that because we are not an American company.
Yeah.
So she left. She signed with Warner. Now after 3 years, She has never had any success in America, but she continues very successfully in Europe.
Okay. All right. Okay. Is she coming back to act?
Well, I visit her. She calls me up when she plays a concert here, or visit even the office with a basket of fruit to be thankful for what we did for her. But
yeah,
she's gone.
She's gone. Okay, let's talk about the art of producing in the studio. By the way, have you any idea how many albums you have produced when you put together the act albums and all the ones before? I mean, it must be hundreds.
It's hundreds, but I don't really know.
You have no idea.
I didn't.
But one third of your life you've been in studios, maybe, or one fourth. Okay, so you're in the studio. Producer is the boss, and with musicians, it's mostly about the vibe. You need a good vibe in the studio, and everybody knows that you have to be quick in the studio for mainly two reasons. First, studios are expensive, but then in the album, you are playing with the same energy level that you're on playing on stage. So, I mean, that energy doesn't last too long. You can't have 12-hour days in studio. How did you learn that? I mean, you learned by doing
No. The truth is, when I recorded my first album back in 1962, it was the first time ever I had seen a recording studio from inside.
Okay.
So I knew nothing.
Yeah.
And it was just, I persuaded my then boss that we should make a record with this wonderful tenor saxophone player,
Klaus
Doldinger.
Yeah.
And the only reason why he agreed to it is because at that moment in time, Stan Getz had the number one hit in America in the pop charts.
Bossa
Nova.
Bossa Nova, yeah.
And then my boss said, well, okay, why don't you give it a try? But it's got to be Bossa Nova.
Yeah.
Now, my artist, Klaus Doldinger, when I approached him, didn't want to hear anything about Bossa Nova because his idea was not Stan Getz. His idea was everybody else, but not Stan Getz.
So
we went into the studio, and I was lucky because the engineer realized that I was a newcomer.
Yeah.
He helped me a lot. But what was important still is you should not go into a studio without a concept.
Yeah.
So, like, at least 50% of what you should do in the studio, you should have in your mind before you even enter the studio.
That's right.
So that's preparation.
Yeah.
Ideas.
Yeah.
You have to have a concept.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I always said it's like writing a story or making a movie.
Yeah.
Not just go and record whatever they just play.
Yeah.
So the concept here was, of course, Bossa Nova.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in the studio itself, I can't help the musician in doing his job as a musician, because I'm not a musician in the first place.
Yeah.
But I have ears.
Yeah.
And I think that's my biggest, how you call it? My
asset.
Biggest asset.
Yes.
Not my biggest ass, but my biggest asset are my ears.
Yeah.
I think I have a pretty good set of ears. I can hear when something is really special.
Yeah.
And I hear things before other people are hearing it. Be it that you hear a piano player sitting in the studio all of a sudden, hey, this man, this individual has something very special to offer.
Yeah.
When you hear him on stage, you say, this is something really new. Or when I heard the Beatles at the Star Club, I felt there is something very new.
Yeah.
You know, at start, which of course it was.
Yeah.
So in the studio, I have to make sure that the musicians find the best possible surroundings.
Yeah.
So the studio has to be good.
Yeah.
The engineer has to be good.
Yeah.
And you have to agree with the artist beforehand what you are going to record.
That's right.
And then in the studio, it is just to make sure that, you know, that it's relaxed atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But then I have to listen. When is the moment when something magic is in the ear,
yeah,
that I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Say, this is it.
Yeah.
And sometimes the artists don't agree with me. You say, ah, let's make a second.
Yeah.
And stuff. Sometimes you said, okay, why not try it?
But yeah.
I was sure it's that one or nothing.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and this really is, so it's a lot of intuition at
yeah.
work.
Yeah.
And of course, in modern days, the role of a producer has changed.
Yeah.
You see, with the rock and roll, really the producer becomes part of the creative process.
Yeah.
I've never been, in that sense,
yeah.
part of the creative process.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just there, you know, to, first of all, give the artist a chance to record.
Yeah.
And then to make sure that the atmosphere is right.
Yeah.
And then third, you know, say, this is it. And then, of course, be also responsible making it happen after yeah. the recording.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, right? Of course. Yeah,
editing
yeah.
it
yeah.
and getting the right title. So it's,
and the cover art, the which cover yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
So this is like a very complex of the idea what a producer should be, and that's of course exactly what all the big producers, until the you know rock and roll came into place,
yeah.
have been.
Yeah.
Nancy Oettingen was a great producer. He was not a musician.
Yeah.
You know, Alfred Lion, the great producer of Blue Note, made all these incredible records.
Yeah.
He was not he was not an artist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he was a producer.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you hear that this take is special. So then you also know that the audience, the record buyers, they will like it. So there is a connection to that. But can you explain the special? It just sounds right to your ears. Is this that simple? Well,
you see, it reminds me on, you know, on Ahmet Oettingen.
Yeah.
It's another.
Yeah.
You know, Nesri was the jazz guy, but Ahmet Oettingen was the big brother. The big guy,
yeah.
the younger brother who found Atlantic
yeah.
and who found all these great, incredible black artists.
Yeah.
You know, the
yeah.
Drifters, Otis Redding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, yeah. Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, name
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And he said in an interview, you know, the same question that you have just been
yeah.
raising is, he said, the thing is, you have to have two sets of ears.
Yeah.
One set is for your personal satisfaction,
yeah.
which is music only.
Yeah.
But the second set of ears is to try to anticipate what the audience might like.
That's right.
And that is what a good, successful producer is made of. He has to have an idea what kind of music will you reach with this kind of music?
Yeah.
What kind of audience
yeah, yeah, yeah.
will
yeah,
you
yeah.
reach with this kind of music?
That's right, yeah.
And that is, of course, the other instinct, and it's experience.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, I don't know how many records I've heard in my life before I even had my first job in the industry.
Yeah.
Millions of hours I spent listening.
So yeah.
my mind and my ears were trained.
That's the education to be a person.
Yeah, 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 yeah,
yeah. yeah. Well, when we have been in studio together, you sometimes have asked me a shorter solo with some fewer notes.
Yes.
and we have selected that take. So usually, in my case, in the first take, I will play a solo which is quite thick on notes and information, and then you say in the talkback, you say, yeah, it's good, but make the solo a little shorter and just calm down, and then I do that. And then we both agree that's the one on the album. So this has been a guideline for you on jazz, not to have too many notes, not too wild solos on the studio albums. And you know that's what people prefer.
Yeah, this is not necessarily what people prefer, but this has something to do with the mechanics of the business.
Yeah.
Because, you know, records have to be bought by a lot of more people than those who come to your actual concert.
That's right.
Because if you just sell people records to people who come to your concert,
yeah.
you can, this is like souvenir business.
Yeah.
So you can play whatever you want. They will take it as a souvenir.
Yes.
But normally there are filters.
Mm-hmm.
filter number one, if you release a record
yeah.
to the marketplace, is our journalists. So journalists, they have to listen to thousands of records.
Yeah.
And then they decide, I like this, I don't like that, whatever.
Yeah.
But again, there, time is an element.
Yeah.
You know, so they cannot and do not longer listen to a long, very long pieces of music for somebody, of especially of somebody that they don't know.
That's right. Yeah.
So therefore, to find an interest, to find their ears to be interested,
yeah.
and then eventually, hopefully, to write positively about it,
mm-hmm.
is the journalists, music journalists.
Yeah.
The second is, of course, the radio, the media.
Yeah.
And now, nowadays, there is not that much jazz on radios, unfortunately. But when we started making records, there was a lot more jazz on yeah. radios. And therefore, again, the shorter the cut is, the greater is the chance that they will be played.
Yeah.
Because even if they have 1 hour of, you know, 1 hour of time to play new jazz.
Yeah.
They will not select the tune that is 8 minutes long.
That's right.
You know, they will select the shortest.
That's right.
So
yeah.
it has something to do with it.
Also that. Okay, yeah, I understand. And the years of ACT has also been the years of digitalization. I mean, Napster already at the late 90s, and then came the streaming and iTunes. But you have survived all that. Was ACT at some point, was it in danger to be, going out of business? Because many independent labels have gone out of business. But did you have your danger years at some point?
No. I mean, the truth of the matter is that our business, it took years to get up.
Yeah.
Because we started, there was nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the artist I worked with started, you know, naming... And, you know, Jazz Spania was not a bad start. Then, of course, we had Nils Langtren. Then came Esbjørn Svensson. Then was not to forget Nguyen Le,
yeah.
who was very, very, very still on the label.
Yeah,
after all these years,
yeah.
he's still on the label. We're just preparing his next album.
Yeah.
I don't even know which number, but probably 22 or 23.
Yeah.
So there is continuity
yeah.
in what we do and in building artists. And,
yeah.
of course, one of the main... But most important things is that I have learned to listen to the artists I work with.
Yeah.
They know the market because they're out there all the time and playing.
Right.
So they
yeah.
hear what's going on.
Yeah.
And of course, when somebody like Nils came with Esbjørn,
yeah.
the rest is history. Or also, if you said, Lars Danielsson.
Mm-hmm.
So I started working with Lars Danielsson or Victoria Tolstoy.
That's right.
I was not really interested working with her because she was wild, when I met her first.
Yeah.
And but of course, then she made a very nice album.
Yeah.
She thought she was a superstar because it was Blue Note.
Yeah, yeah.
Except she didn't realize that it was Blue Note Sweden. The record was never released outside of Sweden.
Too bad.
But then after yeah. a while, she came back and said, I want to be on your label.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, if we get Esbjørn to write the music and play it, then we will do it. And of course that happened.
That was shining on you. Yeah.
So what I'm saying here is we're growing by listening to artists.
Yeah.
For instance, take the most important record we ever did.
Yeah.
And certainly the most record I ever recorded in my life is Bugge Wesseltoft.
Snowing on my piano.
Bugge was part of the All-Star Band even back in 1994.
Yeah.
At the same festival in Salzau.
Yeah.
So I heard him and I liked him.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to get him to work for my label.
Yeah.
So I went to Stockholm first.
Yeah.
And on the wall, Nils had a picture, a painting, not a painting, but a print.
Yeah.
A piano.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, it looked like it's snowing on a piano. So anyway, I said I would like to have this. I like to have a copy of this print.
Yeah.
And he said, "Yeah, but the artist lives in the south of France. He's a good friend. You can call him." I called him up and said, "Do you still have a copy of the print?" "Yeah, sure. Can I use it for a cover?" "Absolutely." So I went to Norway.
Yeah.
Talking to Bugge and trying to persuade him to come. Become an act artist.
He said,
"I just started my own label, Jazzland, and I just made a record that I think is so important." "No." He said, "We might can do work together from time to time, but not an exclusive artist."
Yeah.
So I said, would you be willing to record a Christmas album for me, just solo?"
Yeah.
He said, "Man, I'm not really a big fan of Christmas music." But his little daughter, Maren, she was at the table in September, sitting outside, beautiful weather.
Yeah.
And he said, "Well, maybe I should record an album that she likes."
Mm.
So I said, "Okay." I called from the spot, the Rainbow Studio, which I've never seen before.
Yeah, in Oslo.
And asked for a date. So they said, "Okay," it's 20 September, 2 dates, you can come. And we said, "Okay. Do we have a deal?" "So for one record, yes." So I went same day to Dubai, Christmas sheet music of Christmas songs, put it all together, send it to Booker, said start working on it, and we meet again in the studio.
Wow.
So we made this album.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I said this would be the perfect cover, this picture I'd seen, and called it "It's Snowing on My Piano." So again, this is something, because I wanted to sign the artist that was I saw before in Salzburg. Yeah. We made this record, and it sold way over 200,000 units. But interesting enough, only in Norway and in Germany.
Mm.
It never sold anything outside of these two countries.
Okay.
Although even Bugge became quite a well-known artist later in his own right, on his own label.
Yeah.
But this record, every year, it's number one on the Spotify charts. We're still selling even physical records, but only in Norway and Germany.
Why? You don't
ask me?
Yeah. These are mystical things. Yeah. Well, Christmas is once a year, so at least two countries it works, and that is one part of your job to get the cover. You know, to design the cover. So you probably in the studio already you get some kind of idea what kind of cover you want.
Not really.
Okay. Yeah. And then sometimes you have to work miracles to get the approval from the artists.
You know, often, of course, the images are, you know, of paintings that I have in my own collection.
Yeah.
Even then, I have to get approval by the artist because I don't own the copyright or the picture that I own.
Yeah.
And but of course, often I have, I see things, take a photograph, and then try to find the connection to the artist and the galleries, and then get approval. And it can happen sometimes. It does.
Sometimes.
Just recently, I had, there's a wonderful American artist called Stanley Whitney.
Yeah,
he's a black painter who was. Until he was over 60 before he had his first success, I bought a picture of his as he was unknown.
Yeah.
And I met him in New York, and he's a big music fan.
Yeah.
The painting was called Moondog, a tribute to Moondog, the artist, who died in Münster, Germany.
Yeah.
And of course, but now he's a superstar, absolute superstar. And I tried again to find approval for a new record I did. There was first no answer, then I had to decide something different.
Yeah.
And then yesterday came a mail from the gallery.
Yeah.
Oh, he has approved, he can use it, no problem.
Okay. Well, the future of ACT. How do you? I mean, the future is always difficult to see, but how do you see it?
Well, first of all, the business when we started ACT was 1992.
Yeah.
In 1992 was the biggest year. I mean, in terms of gross turnover and income.
Yeah. In the whole record business. Yeah.
This was the biggest, it was the peak in the history of the recording industry.
Yeah.
Was 1992.
Yeah.
And this was the beginning of a completely new era.
Mm-hmm.
So the digital world, although we had digital recordings,
yeah,
we had this, you know, the CD,
yeah,
of course, which is digital,
yeah,
and it really saved the record industry because
yeah,
it was big boom. People bought the same records again,
yeah,
on you know, that they had on vinyl, again on CD, etc. But then, of course, came the problem with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So people could actually listen and could download the stuff themselves, and
yeah,
right, and the record industry started to decline.
Yeah, late 90s,
dramatically.
Yeah,
it was a dramatic decline.
Yeah,
in us, you know, as the internet and the digital world, you know, became the thing.
Yeah,
many other things too. So also in the print industry, not just music.
Yeah.
And so the record industry had a problem, obviously. And as a result, many of the record companies went out of business.
Yeah.
Even the majors, you know, there were six majors in 1992, and 5 years later, there were only three left, namely Sony, Universal,
Warner.
And Warner.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it became, you know, the death of the independents, because physical records were no longer the major source of income. Mm. More and more downloading, and of course more streaming.
Streaming, yeah.
Because downloading was not good for the record industry, but streaming became the savior of the record industry. And now the business is growing again. But we are producing and promoting music for a very tiny, you know, minority.
Yeah.
It's only 2%. It has never been more than 2% of the total music market.
Yeah.
But now, 2% of the remaining physical market is very little.
Yeah.
And somehow, the people who are streaming are not the people who are interested in our music. And if they listen to established music,
yeah,
even like I said, EST,
yeah,
still the number one streaming artist
yeah,
on the label. But of course, even if you know, if you look to Cannibal Adderley, they have very, very good streaming audiences.
Yeah.
But new music, new artists,
yeah,
have it very, very, very difficult to find an audience via streaming.
That's right.
So this is why we are really in a situation where, you know, I never lived off the income from act. I was fortunate enough to made my money before Warner. So, as I said before, ACT was not a business model, and I could, whatever money we made, and we always made money, we reinvested the money.
Yes.
We put more promotion behind releases than most others.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, when for instance, give you a number, I said over 200,000 for Boge Westeltoff, but of course, Niels and AST, you know, Niels never had a record out of the box that sold less than 50,000.
Wow.
Now we're selling 5,000.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
Espion, of course, we have no releases, so
yeah.
It's another story.
Yeah.
So what I mean is the market for physical recordings have deteriorated almost to non-existence. The only thing that helped lately was the revival of vinyl.
Yeah.
So people started again, say, God, you know, what a wonderful haptic thing to have it in your hands.
And, yeah.
You know, it's bigger, and you can really explore the artwork.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So I think this is the first time in history that something that was already gone and out and done with as a technology, right, like vinyl records, that there's a comeback.
That's right.
So now for us, the vinyl business is the only thing that remains
a
selling item, really.
Yeah.
And we are hoping to develop the streaming business.
It's hard. Yeah.
We know as a company we could not survive if we would continue just to produce records and promote physical records.
Yeah.
So therefore, I was looking for a successor.
Yeah.
Many years before I knew.
Yeah.
You know, I had to find somebody who shares my enthusiasm
yeah.
for music, for artists, and And so I was lucky to find Andreas
the right guy. Yeah, yeah.
And first he was reluctant because people told him, you know, he had a safe job.
Yeah.
He was the you know, the label manager for Deutsche Grammophon.
Yeah.
You know, and he was early 30s.
Yeah.
But he was, you know, he's a jazz drummer. He loves jazz.
And, yeah.
And some people said to him, be careful, you know, Sigi Lauch is a tough nut. And, you know, he could be difficult.
Uh-huh.
And he may never lose, he never let loose mm-hmm. what he did because his own company.
Yeah.
But I told him, listen, I give you a 5-year contract.
Yeah.
To have a guaranteed and secure job.
Yeah.
You can terminate the agreement with 6 months' notice if you feel unhappy.
That was already 2015.
And
yeah.
That made him join the label.
Yeah.
And and now he's a partner.
Yeah.
And he is just running the company, and we started an agency.
Yes.
So now the most part of the activity is the agency.
Yes.
So we have now 12 people under contract, employees.
Yeah.
We never had that many people.
That's right. You're growing.
Act label was never more than 4.
That's right. Yeah.
But now the agency and the label is really becoming.
Yeah.
You know, a bigger company.
And are you now officially retired?
I certainly have nothing to do with the agency. I mean,
yeah.
I talk to Andreas every day. I see him every week.
Yeah.
And we share our thoughts.
Yeah.
But I leave the decision to him.
Yes.
And if it comes to records, I'm a little more involved because I am interested in what he's signing.
Yeah.
And I make my comments.
Yeah.
There have been some records even released that I might have not released when I would have been still running the label.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, there are very good examples already of things that I would not have done and turn out to be really successful.
That's right.
So
he has,
you know, I give him the freedom.
Yeah.
To decide these things. Of course, he's also working very, very close with Michael if it comes to our signings, etc.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and also, you know, Andreas is the best team player I've ever seen in the business. Because he makes the decisions, but he makes sure that always takes the whole team with it.
That's right.
He's a fantastic. Every morning he has a call, team call, and all these things I would have never done.
Okay.
I was the man. You know, I made decisions. You know?
Yeah.
I listened to people, yes, but I made my decisions.
That's right. Yeah.
And then
there's different totally, time to be boss.
Totally different time to be boss. I can't tell you how happy I am that Andreas is now running the label.
Running the label, yes.
My biggest and most prestigious thing that I'm still doing is running Jazz at Berlin Philharmonic.
That's right. And we have one more concert to go.
So, you know.
And this episode have been published before. So we might as well promote the concert. The last Jazz at Berlin Philharmonic concert created by you will be in December. I think it's the 3rd.
Yes.
3rd of December, and it will be 3 pianos. Get your tickets now.
because we started Jazz at Berlin Philharmonic.
That's right.
With the 3 pianos.
Year 2012.
Correct.
And it was Leszek Mocher, Michal Wolny, and me. And now we'll see who is doing the last. That will be a surprise. Sigi, this is the act years. You have given so many artists a voice in Europe. I mean, we know so much more music because of you, because of the artists you have discovered, you have taken them to studio, you have published them. So I think it's fair to say that you have made the European jazz scene much richer than it would have been without you. So thanks for that.
Thank you for your kind words.
Yeah, but that is true.
It's not up to me to say you're right, but I hope you are right.
Yeah, I am right. Thank you for this. Okay.
My pleasure.